I mean, to me, that was heartbreaking because it just felt like their life was being taken from them. Their opportunity was being taken from them for no reason. And I just couldn't accept that.
Some people see horrible things and spend the rest of their lives trying to unsee them. Other people see those same things and spend the rest of their lives doing everything they can devoted to helping. That's pretty much the case with this week's guest, Jane Mosbacher-Morris. So Jane's the founder and CEO of a pretty cool venture called To The Market. And it's a social enterprise that focuses on promoting and selling goods made by survivors of conflict and abuse. Before that, she was at the McCain Institute focusing on anti-human trafficking. And before that, at the U.S. Department of State, the Bureau of Counterterrorism, focusing on global women's issues. She is somebody who is called to serve and has devoted her life to these powerful issues. And the conversation today gets very real, gets very raw. It talks about things that happen in the world that very often in sort of a Western world we're not exposed to. But I think it's an important conversation. And it's important to really expand our global horizon and start to think about what's going on in the world around us and maybe how we can help. So I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that your loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh, personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss. So thank you so much for hanging out with me today, by the way. I know you've been bopping all around. We're hanging out in New York City right now. I want to go back into your journey a little bit, but I think it's kind of cool why you're in New York. So why don't we just kind of dive into this and tell me what's going on right now, why you're in New York City, and then we'll take a step back and kind of trace how you got here.
I'm in New York right now because yesterday, March 10th, we ended up launching a partnership with UN Women, where they are focusing on ethical fashion and sustainable sourcing. And so To The Market was one of their brand partners. So I had the pleasure of participating in an event yesterday where they were focusing on the 20-year anniversary of a very famous speech that was given in Beijing talking about the status of women. And so we were sort of all looking at what progress has been made and what progress do we want to see in the next 20 years. So yeah. It was really special.
Let's go into that a little bit. Tell me a little bit more about the conversations around that. What were sort of like the big themes about where we've come from and where, I say we as if I'm one of the women, but where sort of the conversation was around where women have come since that speech in the last 20 years. And what I'm curious about the conversation about like the forward-looking conversation too.
Well, it is we because it's humanity. Yeah. Where is humanity right now?
Right.
And there has been a lot of progress made with regards to laws on the books, especially around women's political participation and gender-based violence. Mm. And so we've seen a number of countries that previously essentially allowed for things like domestic violence to be sanctioned within the household to be at least on the books illegal, and at least for women to have the right to participate in politics. The not great part is the progress that's made on the actual numbers, meaning that there is still a tremendous problem with gender-based violence. And the rate of growth of women's political participation, while we have these wonderful outliers like the president of Liberia, the rate of growth overall, I think, is something like 11%, which could be a lot better. So there was a lot of discussion about participation in all parts of community, at the political level, in the workforce, and then, of course, talking about the safety and sort of view of women within a community, whether they are fully valued as equal partners.
Yeah. And it seemed because your language was very precise around like the progress was around that there are laws, there are on the books protections. But my sense is also that the reality on the ground is that, okay, so step one is that we've got it codified in some way. But then what I'm getting from you, there's a huge leap between, okay, it's now on the books, but this is the day-to-day reality for women in these places in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, implementation is 90% of anything, in my opinion.
No.
And so, of course, the letter of the law is important because you want to have something to enforce if there's the will to enforce. But oftentimes there's not the will to enforce, and you're battling against, I mean, generations of, would be an understatement, you know, thousands of years of viewpoint on what's acceptable and what's not acceptable with regards to how a girl or a woman is treated in many of these communities. And so, especially when you get into more rural or local areas that are less connected with maybe the national government, it can be very hard to see progress.
Yeah. So can we, at the risk of getting graphic, I think it's probably important to actually, you know, because we can talk about, what you know, in general ideas, but my sense is that most of the people who are listening to this podcast really have no idea what we're talking about. They really have no exposure. Maybe they've read a little bit, but are you comfortable sort of going into, okay, this is what, you know, in one of the areas of the world that we're talking about, what might a girl's life or a woman's life actually be like on a day-to-day basis? What are some of the things that you're actually talking about, like really and them being exposed to or experiencing that we're talking about here?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are a number of examples I'd love to share. I want to preface it by saying that in each of these communities, rarely are people doing things that they think is wrong. Mm. It really is culturally what they were taught to be okay. And so they don't think that they're hurting their daughter or their wife. They think that this is acceptable. And so I want to preface it by saying that I'm not trying to condemn these communities, but just sort of share what the reality is like for many girls and women in these communities.
Yeah,
so
understood.
There are a number of customs that I would argue negatively impact the trajectory of a community at large. So not just the girl or the woman, but the community and ultimately, I believe, the nation. Things like early childhood marriage, where you are essentially in a situation where a young girl could be forcibly married off to a much older relative. And when I say much older, it could be anywhere from, you know, somebody in their 30s to somebody in their 60s or 70s. Mm. And when I say girl, I mean, I'm talking folks as young as 9 or 10.
Oh, my God.
And clearly the girl doesn't have the option to refuse that marriage in most scenarios. And, of course, you know, they can be older. They could be 16 or 17. But it's the fact that they are being forced into a dynamic that they don't want that I think is very troubling. And then, unfortunately, when things like early childhood marriage take place, oftentimes the girl is prevented from continuing her education. She's often forced to live with the family of her husband. And there's a dynamic of control that is, you know, she has very little control, and her husband's family tends to sort of take control of her. So that would be an example of something that is fairly common in many countries. Another would be female genital mutilation, which some people have described as female circumcision. And that is another very dangerous practice that leads to horrible and heartbreaking health issues, especially around childbirth. And it's a deeply rooted custom in many, many religious communities, so it's not unique to a specific religion. It very much so is cultural. And again, it can – the health impact can keep a girl out of school. It can prevent her from having healthy babies. It can shorten her life significantly if it leads to infection, which it often does because of the way that the cutting is done. So that would be another example. And then, you know, unfortunately, there's this incredibly high rate around the world of violence against women. And it's the majority of the time it is done by intimate partners. So either a husband or a father, so somebody that they have a relationship with. And the impact of being the target of violence is everything from mental health impacts of depression and anxiety and PTSD to, of course, physical, where, you know, women and girls are losing their life constantly from violence. And then the impact that that then has, the sort of trickle effect of being abused then impacts the way that they parent. It's a horrible, sort of has a horrible multiplying effect, which happens in every country around the world, in the United States and, you know, and in the developed world and in the developing world. You know, we are in no means immune to the issue of violence against women, and it has to stop.
Yeah. I mean, it's which goes back to exactly why you very gently corrected me when at first I said, well, that's, I'm not a woman, so I can't. But I appreciate that because I think it's an important thing to say, you know, that, it's a societal issue that, you know, the violence, the limitations, the constraints may be, you know, the direct impact may be on women, but the ripple, as you just used the word, is affects every single one of us on every level. But what you said is really, I guess maybe this is what makes it so challenging is that, and I appreciate the way that you prefaced when I asked you, okay, you know, like what does this actually look like? You know, what does this really paint the picture? And you said, let me first say that in the local societies very often where this is happening, there's the culture, it's just the way it is. And it's not perceived as something wrong or something. It's just the accepted way. So people don't perceive themselves as repressing or imposing or harming. It's just that's the way the culture says it's okay. So I guess the question there, I guess, and maybe this is part of the really the root of the struggle is How do you then bridge the gap between the book, you know, the rules that you work so hard to even put on the books? Yeah, and that battle is one battle in itself. But then if the culture doesn't look at those rules and validate them, you know, and the culture just says, but what we're doing is okay. And the people believe it in the fiber of their beings because it's been passed down for generation to generation. They really believe that it's okay and that the rules are just somebody from the outside trying to impose an outside culture and determination about them being wrong on something that they know in the heart or they believe to be okay. How do you even begin that conversation?
It's tough. And, you know, I would also add that certainly in female genital mutilation, in the situation of domestic violence and in early childhood marriage, women are oftentimes just as problematic in perpetuating these practices as men because it happened to them and they think that that's the way it is. So oftentimes it's the mother even that's very keen on marrying off their daughter or very keen on ensuring that, you know, they undergo the ritual of FGM. And I think what doesn't work is having somebody on the national level say, what you're doing is wrong and you're backwards and we know better than you. So you need to, you know, you need to adapt. That's what doesn't work. Okay. What I've seen work better is working on the local level and empowering local community leaders to be your credible voices on the ground, talking about why X practice is not beneficial to the community and what the sort of negative impacts of that practice are on the health of the girl or the woman or the boy, if it, you know, depending on what we're talking about, or the man, why it is not in the best interest of the community to continue that. But it's a dialogue. It's not a lecture. And it takes time. So patience is an integral part of the formula in working on these issues. I mean, you know, we in the United States, or if you even look at, you know, countries that are thought to be extremely progressive, like thinking about some of the Nordic states, they still struggle with issues like violence against women. So there's not, no state has it, you know, has it 100% worked out because we as humans are so imperfect.
Yeah. And I guess that's part of the message also is that, you know, we can talk about, you know, FGM and we talk about, oh, that's happening in other parts of the world, which seems so foreign to so many people. But the truth is, I mean, there's tremendous violence that happens, you know, pretty much anywhere. If you're listening to this in the U.S. or the U.K. or Australia, which is sort of our three biggest communities, it's happening in your backyard, you know, and potentially a lot closer than that. It may be very sadly happening to some people who are listening to this right now. Yeah, so it's such a big issue. It's almost difficult to know where to dive in the conversation. But you became involved in the conversation. Take me back to how this, the whole conversation became a part of your life.
Well, I started my professional career after my education working on the issue of counterterrorism. And I was at the U.S. State Department for our Australian and Canadian friends. That's like our foreign affairs department.
So this is, you were in D.C. at the time?
I was in Washington, D.C. Yeah. And almost immediately, I was tasked to look at how the State Department, who I was working for, how they were working with women on the issue of terrorism. And what I found was that we weren't doing a lot of work with women on that issue, on the issue of terrorism. And I thought that that was an opportunity for us to really begin to speak more with women about this issue of terrorism because, in my opinion, the use of violence to advance a political objective, which, you know, is thought of as sort of the general definition of terrorism, if that's how we think of it, then that's a norm. It's a norm whether you think that's acceptable or it's not. Mm. Some families think it is, some families don't. And so I thought, well, women are often the primary conveyors of norms in their family. They're the ones having the conversation about drinking underage or about, you know, use of drugs or whatever, you know, whatever sort of norms exist within a society. So I thought, well, gosh, certainly there's an opportunity for us to equip women and engage women in a way that allows them to engage their community and their family about this issue. And so we did. We began to do that. And what I found was that in so many of the countries where we were focused, the role of women was so diminished because of what I viewed as a lack of economic independence, meaning a lack of any sort of fallback money. It didn't have to be that the woman was the primary breadwinner or even worked or worked part-time. It was just the lack of any sort of nest egg that if something happened, that they'd be okay. And that could be something happened. It could be meaning, you know, their husband was abusive, or it could be that their husband got hit by a car and was not able to provide for the family anymore. But it had to be something that they felt like they had that little bit of leverage, a little bit of control over their life, where they felt confident in pushing back if they needed to. And I was concerned by what I viewed as a lack of economic independence for women in so many of these communities where they weren't being listened to, where they had no room to push back, or they felt like they had no room to push back. And that really sort of planted a seed to me about what is the role of economic independence with regards to having control over your life, even some tiny amount of control over your life. Fast forward in my career, I began to expand my look at not only sort of the intersection of women and national security issues, but really women and human security. And
so I want to get it, but I want to actually dive a little bit deeper, because I'm still unclear on the connection between the scenario you were just talking about and how that becomes a security issue.
So if I am, let's take Afghanistan, which is a country that we worked in.
Right.
If I'm trying to equip the women of Afghanistan to have a voice within not only their family, maybe their community, maybe at the national level, I'm trying to say, your voice matters. If they come to me and say, I can't say that to my husband, like that's not acceptable. Like he would be shocked if I pushed back on him like that. It's very hard to sort of just grant them autonomy and power if they don't have any real power. And economic independence gives you power. So our mission on the sort of terrorism and women intersection was, we wanted women to play a bigger role in fighting terrorism. We wanted them to be talking to their families that this was not the answer. Using these tactics was not the answer. We wanted them to play a bigger role in speaking out within the community. Our community is opposed to violence. We want to play a role in conflict resolution. We want to be a part of peace talks. All of these different pieces that, you know, are a part of preventing terrorism or reacting to terrorism. We wanted women to be involved. Okay. We wanted them to be advocates for resolution. But it was hard to elevate them, to have that credible voice within their community if they were thought of as being so powerless.
Yeah, right.
And it was that economic independence that I would see sometimes that would give them that power. When I would see an instance in which a woman was a primary breadwinner, let's say she was an artisan and she was the one who was bringing home the bacon, so to say, she had a lot more control over the family dynamic than if she had, you know, if she was completely dependent on her spouse to support herself and her children. And so that's where I really was exposed to how much economic independence can impact one. And it's not just a woman. I think just traditionally women tend to be more economically dependent on their spouse. But that was really where I learned how impactful having even some form of economic independence was to her ability to express herself, to be an equal partner, if not even a, you know, thought of as a partner in the family and the community in the country.
Right. So that's all right. So I get now I see the fabric now.
Okay.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lumi. So listen, we have all had those awkward moments where a BO strikes at the worst possible time. I'm often actually out in nature when I'm exercising, so I don't even notice it when I'm out. And then I walk in the door, kind of start to wrinkle my nose, and then I'm like, oh, wait a minute, that's actually me. That is why I'm so thankful I discovered Lumi Whole Body Deodorant. This revolutionary product, it was actually invented by an OBGYN who wanted a solution for her patients struggling with private odor. But Lumi doesn't just work, quote, down there. It provides incredible 72-hour protection for your entire body using mandelic acid. I kid you not, this stuff is a game changer. Lumi is safe and effective for pits, for feet, you name it. And as someone who's tried it, I can attest that it seriously works. The fresh scents are just an added bonus. So if you're ready to say goodbye to BO for good, try Lumi Starter Pack. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like mini body wash, and deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for our listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi starter pack with the code GOODLIFE at LumiDeodorant.com. Don't miss your chance to experience the relief of true full body freshness that equates to over 40% off your starter pack when you visit LumiDeodorant.com or just click the link in the show notes and use the code GOODLIFE. Good Life Project is sponsored by Quince. So my wife actually originally introduced me to Quince because she loves their clothing, and I have been hooked ever since. I literally lived in their Mongolian cashmere ribbed beanie and pullover hoodie pretty much all winter. And as the weather warms up, I wanted more breathable summer pieces without overpaying. And Quince has just the super high quality items like linen shirts, performance polos, activewear at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the middleman to pass savings to customers. Actually just ordered a new European linen long sleeve button down shirt. Super excited to get that. And I'm always just so amazed at how they can keep their prices so affordable while the quality remains really high. So if you're looking to upgrade your wardrobe, I highly recommend you try Quince. Go to quince.com/GLP for free shipping on your order and a 365-day return. That's quince.com/GLP to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/GLP or just click the link in the show notes. Trust me, your wardrobe will thank you. So from there, this is the initial exploration to be. It feels to me personal to you. Like what's the deeper why here for you? What's like driving you? What's bringing you into this on a deeper level?
I really value my independence. I have an extraordinary husband that is, I just feel like I hit the jackpot. I mean, he is incredibly supportive, treats me like a queen. I mean, he's such a wonderful, wonderful man, but I'm very independent and he knows that. And it was so hard for me to see so many of the women that were smart and capable and hungry. They wanted to learn to read, or they wanted to continue their education, or they wanted to work. They wanted to make a better life for their children, to not be able to because somebody else said so. I mean, to me, that was heartbreaking because it just felt like their life was being taken from them. Their opportunity was being taken from them for no reason. And I just couldn't accept that.
So where do you go from there?
So after being exposed to this sort of role of economic independence, I expanded my focus to include issues of what we call human security, which is sort of the technical term for things like domestic violence, sexual assault, human trafficking. It's really literally the security of your person. And that's when I really saw that this economic independence piece was even more critical than I thought, because I was seeing people who had been traumatized, whether it was trafficking, sexual assault, domestic violence, not being able to leave that dynamic because of their lack of economic independence. And I just thought, this has to change, because when looking at the programming, meaning what types of help was being provided on the ground, and I looked at the policies that governments were making around some of these issues, like human trafficking, like sexual assault, like domestic violence, I was seeing a tremendous focus on what we would call social service provision, which would be things like emergency housing, pro bono legal assistance, medical, you know, services, psychological services, all invaluable. I would never advocate
right.
that they
sort
not
of like
be
intervention based.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely. And it's very much so emergency intervention,
right?
So you're not going to provide somebody housing for the rest of their life. You're providing them a bed until they can find another place to sleep.
Right.
So that very issue to me was problematic. We were doing, the vast majority of folks that were engaged in this space were engaging with this population of people on a short-term basis around this social service provision. And I wasn't seeing as much focus on the rest of the trajectory of these survivors' lives. Meaning I was seeing them, if they were lucky enough, and most are not, if they had access to these social services, if they were able to go to a shelter, if they were able to access legal services, with which the vast majority of folks are not, then I was seeing oftentimes them, you know, going through the system. Hopefully they have success with their work. But then it was oftentimes they were sort of released into the world and we sort of wish them luck.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, you know, it's not
it's
ideal.
It's a step, but
it's
not
a step.
It's not a solution.
It's not a long-term solution.
I mean, it's
solution.
Interesting. It's so clear that, you know, there's a piece of the puzzle that which is helpful, but there's probably a ton of sort of almost retreat when there isn't something better to move into, which is, you know, support along the way. One of the things that strikes me a little bit is we're almost talking about it in, I hate to use the phrase, but almost like a big data type of way right now, like they. Along, as you're doing this work, were there any moments or personal stories or personal contacts that kind of touched you on a level where that made you feel so connected or that really stood out to you, that just really illustrated where the pain was and where you had to, felt like you were called to step in?
Absolutely. So anytime I've been on the ground working with these survivor populations, I'm exposed to different stories that really remind me why our work is so critical and has the ability to change generations of people. I would say there are two sort of stories in particular that have been very, very moving, both which took place in India. One is I was very keen to identify how I could assist survivors in a way that would fill a gap and would not be sort of reinventing the wheel. And I was in Calcutta, India, 2 years ago to learn about human trafficking within India. And we visited red light districts and we visited aftercare facilities where traditionally someone who had either escaped or was rescued would be sort of going through the healing process. But then at the end of the trip, we visited these two social enterprises, so these socially inspired businesses that were started both in Calcutta's red light districts for the purpose of providing employment to human trafficking survivors. And seeing the survivors working in both of those different co-ops was incredibly touching for me, because when I'd previously worked, especially with traumatized communities, you don't feel like you're on equal footing with them in a way, because it's so clear that they are the beneficiary and you're the grand, you know, you are the grantor. Mm. I loved that working with these social enterprises, it felt like equal footing. They were providing a service because they were working and they were being paid for their work. And there was a pride and a dignity in their eyes that I had not seen in traditional, just strictly not-for-profit models. And that was a turning point for me, because to me, that signaled the dignity of work and the opportunity to earn an income and the ability to then make choices about your life with that income was huge. When you are receiving a social service, you do not generally have control over what you are being given, right? If I'm in a refugee camp, I can't say to you, you know, we've had rice for the last 5 days and I'm sick of rice. Or I can't say, you know, this bed is really not comfortable. I'm not interested in this area of town. I don't want to go to the shelter. You don't have choices like that. When you earn an income, you get to make those decisions. Is it maybe limited decisions if you have a limited income? Sure. But it's decisions. And so I loved that these survivors had regained control over their life. Because when you're traumatized, whether, again, whether it's trafficking or you've been in a war zone or you've contracted HIV/AIDS, where you've had this experience that's traumatic, control has been taken from you. You don't choose to be in a war zone, generally, you know, unless you are signing up to be in the military. You don't choose to contract HIV/AIDS, or you don't choose to be abused. These are things that have happened to these people. Control has been taken from them. So I loved the concept of them being able to regain control over their life. And that's what I saw there. And that was a turning point for me, where I was committed to trying to support the model of employing survivors so that they could take care of themselves. Mm. The other story is also in India. I spent time in Mumbai red light district with many of the girls, little girls that were the daughters of women that were trapped there and they hadn't left yet. And it was very difficult for me to leave, knowing that if their mothers don't get out, the daughters have a very limited chance of not being trafficked within that community, within that red light district, meaning their fate is, I don't want to say sealed, but it would be very hard to grow up, be living in that red light district and not be exploited. And that's when I really realized that the work could be multi-generational, because if I can get the mother out or get her economically independent, she can get the daughter out. So that was something that, knowing that those girls are still there, you know, and they can't leave. That's what, you know, is so heartbreaking, is sometimes folks will say, well, gosh, can't they just like walk out? And what I think there is limited understanding around is in many of these cases, people are bought. I mean, no, you can't walk out. Those girls couldn't just jump in the car with us and drive away, because they were thought to be owned. And there are people that guard, you know, stand at the end of these districts and make sure that you're not leaving. You have to buy your freedom. And it's the same in, you know, you could be in Australia or the UK and the US in an abusive relationship. Why don't they just walk away? Well, because usually these people have been isolated. They've been told that nobody's going to help them, that they could go to jail, that, you know, that they are not valued by anyone but the abuser. I mean, they've been brainwashed into thinking that they can't. So they don't.
So you come back from those experiences and decide you got to do something about it.
Yeah. I mean, my experience in Calcutta was 2 years ago. My visiting the girls was much more recent, after I started to the market. That was just sort of a reminder of how impactful this type of work can be. but it certainly, I felt very clearly called to be a part of that space. And it took me about 9 months to figure out what I was going to do in that space. Because again, I didn't want to reinvent the wheel. I wanted to understand, what is it like to employ survivors? What is working? What's not working? How can I help? What are my skill sets versus the needs? And ultimately, based on having conversations with as many folks as I did who were employing survivors all over the world and all types of survivors, survivors of abuse, survivors of conflict, survivors of disease, I built my model based on what they shared with me.
So what'd you build?
So To the Market has three focus areas. One of our focus areas is assisting these organizations that are already out there working with these survivor populations, helping them to sell the products that they make. So the most common way that these groups tend to employ these survivor populations is by employing them to produce products. And the reason they do that is because in many parts of the world where these organizations are based, there is an existing capacity to do things like beading or sewing that is ingrained in the culture that they are able to very quickly build upon. And that is a very quick confidence builder for the survivor they're working with. And it's something that is reflective of the culture that a consumer tends to like. They want to feel like the piece generally that they're buying is somewhat sort of tied with the culture where they bought it. And so we assist these organizations employing survivors to sell their products. So that's a huge sort of focus. The second piece of the model is storytelling. We feel like we have an opportunity to do advocacy around the issues that we've been talking about today, sharing with folks what's going on in the world so that they might be inspired to do something and to help and to get involved and to keep their eyes open for these types of social justice issues. And also there's an opportunity for us to really provide a platform for some of the survivors to tell their story and to sort of share what they've gone through and what they're looking forward to in their life. So we also see that as sort of a cathartic opportunity for them. And then the third piece of our model is trying to assist these organizations that are employing survivors to be essentially more efficient and effective. So, for example, we provide things like trend forecasting, which is a tool that talks about what the trends are for the upcoming season, so that if I'm a co-op in New Delhi and I see that long necklaces are going to be in style and I make jewelry, that I might want to make more long necklaces for the upcoming season than I would be, chokers or whatever it is. So that would be an example of the type of feedback and advice that we try to provide to assist them in being more efficient and more effective.
Right. So, the storytelling, three big pieces of the puzzle, which fill in that gap from the emergency intervention to, okay, how do I become independently sustainable and create my own economic opportunity, which allows me that then freedom of choice to a certain extent to choose the scenario that I want for me, my family, moving forward. The storytelling element's got to be a huge part of it. I'm curious what you're doing with that. But it's also got to be a really delicate part of it too. I mean, how do you tell those stories in a way that that shows? So I'll give an example. A friend of mine works in experiential learning with at-risk kids, and when she goes to sponsors and people to help contribute to her organization, she wants to tell the story of the at-risk kids. But if the kids are in the room, nobody wants to be labeled an at-risk kid. So it's kind of like this thing. How do you tell a really powerful story that's truthful and honest and shows the raw nature of what's going on and the deep need, and at the same time tell it in a way that honors and exalts the humanity of the person whose story you're telling? It's got to be a really delicate balance for you.
It is. I think the first step is making sure that whoever you're talking to wants to talk to you and has the right to refuse any question you ask. We are very keen to ensure that whoever person we're interviewing has consented to the interview, knows that they can stop it at any time, has the right of refusal if they change their mind. I mean, a number of different sort of pieces that we've tried to build in to be as respectful as possible. And then, of course, ultimately, if we deem that it would put them at risk, we're not doing the story.
Of course.
So there are those sort of safeguards built in. With regards to the tone, however, I think we chose to use the word survivors and not victims. And that's super important to us, because what most of these folks will tell you is, again, as I noted earlier, they don't want to be known for something that happened to them. And in some of these cases, maybe it only happened once. Let's take an instance of sexual assault or domestic violence. That's one piece of the puzzle of their entire life. They have a lot more to tell. They are a human too. They have dreams and aspirations and life experiences that might be different. And we try to stay as future focused as we can when we talk to the survivors, so that they feel like they have the opportunity to talk about what they're looking forward to and, you know, things that they have benefited from having this economic independence. So we try to sort of provide a brief context of their experience, but really focus on them as an individual and what's their favorite part of, you know, do you have a favorite jewelry piece that you make, or do you have a favorite color, or tell me about, you know, what it's like raising a daughter, you know, what is she looking forward to? Things like that recognize that what happened to them is one small part of their tapestry.
Yeah, that there's hope and possibility still within them, and that there's a light, there's a spark.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I, you know, one of the things that I did was, you know, I have two survivors on our advisory board, which, again, they provide all sorts of advice to us. But one of the things that they provide advice around is how we engage with survivors. Because as someone at, I believe, the State Department used to say, although I'm not sure if he coined this phrase, but I love it and I repeat it a lot, nothing about them without them, meaning that they need to be a part of the leadership and whatever you're working on, they're part of the focus group. So that was important to us.
That is a great motto for pretty much everything.
I think so too.
In life. I love that, actually. Nothing about them without them. Yeah, that's really powerful.
I think so too.
It stops you from just assuming that you know better, you know what they want, you know, how they want to receive it. Yeah, that's powerful.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Where are you at with what you're doing now?
So To the Market launched, sort of soft launch, I would say, in January 2014, which is when I left my previous job. I had left in December of 2013. I was at that point working for the McCain Institute, which was founded by Senator McCain and Mrs. Cindy McCain. And I was really working with Mrs. Cindy McCain on human trafficking. So I had left the Institute and started to the market in January 2014. And we began with creating pop-up shops, which is where, let's say that there is a big event like this UN Status on Women sort of week right now, where you would go and you'd set up shop for a limited amount of time. So we began with selling products that way, and then also with custom sourcing, where we would have somebody like the McCain Institute or a major anti-trafficking group come to us and say, we would love to do a logoed bag for our conference or for our corporate gift around the holidays. And some of our co-ops have the ability to do that. Mm. And so I, you know, began to sort of facilitate that. In the meantime, we were building our online presence, which tothemarket.com launched in November of 2014. So that added a third distribution channel for survivor-made goods. And in 2015, we are just beginning our retail partnerships, where we're working with retailers to have either product on their site or in stores. So that's sort of the fourth level of distribution channels that we are creating for these organizations employing survivors.
Right. It's this kind of interesting juxtaposition to the one-for-one model that's been so popular in the market for a number of years now. I guess it was really kicked off a lot with Tom's. But in a way, you know, it's so interesting because that model is about giving. You know, and it's, and what you were saying before is, well, somebody's still not in control of that. You know, they're waiting for somebody to give them a pair of shoes or to give them a pair of glasses, which is still wonderful. You, there's some benefit where there may not have been before, but there's not control. And what you're doing is stepping in and saying, no, like I'm creating a direct channel for you to create something of value. And then, you know, have a certain amount of will and choice over how much I create, when I create, and the value that I get in exchange for it. And then if I want to go and purchase a pair of shoes, I'm going to buy them.
And I'm going to pick out what I want.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, it may sound like a slight difference, but it's got to be psychologically just a world of difference.
I think it's significant. I really think it's significant. I really like the one-for-one model, or even it's even more, it's more than just the one-for-one. I think that there has been a number of organizations that have said, okay, for every $100 hat that I sell, 20% of the proceeds are going to go to this community that, you know, lacks warm clothing, let's say. And again, I think that's terrific. Any way that a company is willing to bring in a social element in a way that's sustainable is terrific. However, I think that employing the communities that you are trying to assist is a very special way of working with them.
Yeah, especially communities where they've been through something which is very fiercely stripped autonomy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I would argue that even if we're looking at sort of the broader issue of poverty alleviation, I think there has been, unfortunately, and obviously not intentionally, but a lot of damage done in communities where the donor culture is overwhelming. Because what happens is folks begin to expect things for free. Let me give you an example. Africa has had certain countries where there are tremendous outside donor presence that are working on the ground, providing services, everything from food to medicine to business mentorship. And what that can do is create a resistance to a willingness to pay for those things. So let's say you and I are both, again, this is just an example. Let's say you and I are both Kenyan and we're in Kenya, and I'm selling oranges. Well, you might not want to buy my orange if you can get an orange for free from somebody else, even if you can afford it. If you can get it free from, you know, XYZ organization, you're going to be resistant to paying for it because you think you can get it for free. And I know that that sounds like a first world problem, but it can have a psychological impact on a community, specifically, I think, around self-esteem. If somebody has been in an instance where they have not earned what they've been given for an extended period of time, they might not, and there are plenty of, you know, instances in which they deserve not to, quote, earn what they're given.
Sure.
I
think the blanket proclamation is, like, we understand their extreme circumstances and people in desperate need, and that's not what we're really talking
about. We're talking about instances where a community has developed to a place where they can begin to take over different parts of the economy. And there's an unwillingness there in many instances to do that because I think a combination of feeling like, well, why would we pay for something that we can get for free? And then also thinking that maybe they don't have the skill sets to manage it or to run it or whatever it is. There's this sort of erosion of independence again, where people don't even realize that they've come to expect certain, I don't want to use the word entitlements because I think it's so associated with, you know, conversations about welfare in the United States or whatever right. it is, but they have become so used to donors providing services that the transition is very difficult for them to make. And so I think working in a community where from the beginning you say, I want to work with you to give you the opportunity you deserve, and it's going to be a job. You're going to work for that opportunity. To me, that is a more sustainable way to work in a community that you want to serve, and I think it preserves one's human dignity better than creating solely a perpetual grantor-grantee environment. Mm.
What's your greatest hope for the organization?
My hope for To the Market is that we can scale, but scale in a way that's sustainable so that the organizations that we've partnered with that are employing these amazing survivors are able to not only continue to pay their employees, but ideally bring on more survivors if that's what they so desire. It doesn't, not everybody desires to grow, and that's fine. Many organizations have decided that they want to be grassroots at a certain, you know, within certain constraints, and that's okay. That works for some folks. Yeah. Other folks have a desire to grow significantly, and we want to help them do that. But in a way that is sustainable.
Right. What's your greatest hope for the survivors?
My greatest hope for our survivors is that they recognize their self-worth and that they communicate that self-worth to their children. So that if there is a mindset around believing that they are not as worthy or they've done something wrong or they're being punished for something, that that's not passed on to their children and that they believe in their heart of hearts that they are just as valuable as their head of state. That's my hope for them.
So the name of this is Good Life Project. So coming kind of full circle back to your journey, if I offer that term out to live a good life, I want to ask you this on two levels, actually. I'm going to ask you to kind of speak as a proxy on one level and then also just speak from your heart about you. And to the extent you feel comfortable about the former, that would be great. But first, just for you, when I offer that term out to live a good life, what is that to you?
I think a good life to me is service to others. I think faith is very important to me, and I think we were made to serve others. I think that's the purpose of life, is to improve the life of others. And it doesn't have to be, you know, you're improving the life of someone you've never met in a country on the other side of the world. It can be that you're improving the life of your spouse or your friends or your children. But I think service to others is why we were created. I am most happy when I am serving others and feeling like I'm improving their quality of life while they are on this earth. I also am incredibly fortunate that I have, again, an amazing, amazing husband. I have a wonderful family that is hugely supportive of me and has always been supportive of me. And I know as I get older, I realize how rare that really was, that I had such incredible examples in both of my parents and in other people within my family and within my community that were modeling not only good values, but things like a strong work ethic. I realize now how fortunate I am to have that. And then I have incredible friends that I think would do anything to support me. And I feel the same way about them. So to me, that sort of sums up what I would define as a good life. And I think I have an amazing life. I mean, I just feel like I knocked it out of the park.
So now I'm going to ask you the other question. And again, if you feel like it's not something you can speak to, just tell me. The survivors who you're in service of, how do you think they would reflect on the question to live a good life in their, through the eyes of the experience? And again, I realize you're talking about people who survived a wide variety of different things and radically different cultures. But having so much more exposure to them than I've ever had in my life, what's your sense of how, like, what would be the things that would really rise up in their minds to, this would make me okay, like, this would let me live a good life?
Basic needs, a place to lay my head, enough food to eat that I'm not hungry, personal security, water, access to education, basic education. I mean, I think that to them defines that they are in a good place. And I think I would say that would be what folks would say, whether, you know, we're talking about my local shelter in Lexington, Kentucky, or we're talking about a shelter in, you know, Nairobi. I think folks would still say the same thing because, you know, if you talk to folks at your local, you're in the United States and you're talking to folks in your local rape crisis center or domestic violence shelter or human trafficking shelter, all they're thinking about right now is, well, where am I going to sleep for the next 2 months? Where is going to be my home? Where am I safe? So, obviously things like accessing food and water can be much easier in places in the developed, quote, developed world. But things like personal security and having a place to lay your head, those are still rarities. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the number of shelter beds available to things like human trafficking victims, I mean, you're talking about a tiny sliver of people that are able to access shelter compared to the need.
Yeah. It makes me reflect on what we're doing with this project sometimes. You know, when I have the opportunity to sit down with somebody like you who's really spent a substantial amount of time working with and in service of people who are in just such a radically different place than most people in the Western world are and will ever be exposed to, you sometimes forget, you know, the opportunity for us to answer a question like this, saying like gratitude or in service of or love, whatever it may be, it's a blessing, you know? And maybe part of what we're here to do is be in service of others to the point where maybe they can start to explore the next level of answers to the question that we have the luxury of exploring.
Absolutely. Yeah. We are so fortunate to have our basic needs met.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure. Hey, I really enjoyed that conversation. If you found it valuable as well, would so appreciate if you would just head on over to iTunes, take a couple of seconds, and let us know. Share a review or a rating, always honest. And if you found this episode, the conversation, valuable and you think other people, maybe friends or family, would enjoy it and benefit from it, go ahead and share it with them as well. And as always, if you want to know what's going on with us at Good Life Project, then head over to goodlifeproject.com. And that's it for this week. I'm Jonathan Fields, signing off for Good Life Project.